Now, another hour of Smart Talk, 620 KPOJ, Portland's talk.
New York, to the hills of Los Angeles, a voice is rising to serve justice. This is the Norman Goldman Show, the home of fierce independence, intelligent dialogue, and passionate logic is right here, right now. Sitting in for Norm, here is Adam Klugman, host of Mad as Hell in America Radio. Heard Saturdays on AM 620, Portland's Talk, KPOJ.
Welcome back to the third hour of the Norman Goldman Show, the place where justice is served and where fierce independence is the norm. Wow, that Jeff Clements was a smart cat. I liked him very much. His new book, it's called Corporations Are Not People, coming out January 9th in bookstores. You can get it online just about anywhere. Do check it out. I love having smart people on the show and just letting them talk and be smart. It's one of the great things about being able to get on the radio is inviting really smart people that are going to help us make sense of a world that seems to be spiraling out of control. But sometimes that's the good news, because the closer we get, the more desperately we feel out of control, the more willing we are to hear new ideas and new ways of doing things. And that's exactly what we need to be doing. We need to be considering entirely new ways of doing things in this country. We don't want to go back. We want to go forward. This is an evolution, not a de-evolution. Although Devo was one of my favorite bands when I was a long-haired freak in the 70s. But that's another story for another day. My next guest is also a very smart individual who has really committed his life to rethinking the way that we do things in this country. His name is Gar Alperovitz. His new book is called America. Well, it's not a new book, but there's a reissue of the book. It's called, and we're going to get into why that is. America Beyond Capitalism is the book. Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. And I know that that sounds really good to me. I'm sure it sounds good to you. GarAlperovitz.com. GarAlperov as in Victor. ITZ.com. I'm going to read his bio now. Gar Alperovitz has had a distinguished career as a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He is currently the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard Institute of Politics, the Institute for Policy Studies, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. This is a heavy cat. He is also the president of the National Center for Economic and Security Alternatives and is founding principal of the University of Maryland-based Democracy Collaborative, a research institution developing practical, policy-focused, and systematic paths towards ecologically sustainable, community-oriented change and the democratization of wealth. Gar Alperovitz, welcome to the Norman Goldman Show.
Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So your book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, as I said, sounds really good. Let's start with kind of the same place that I started with Jeff Clements, which is let's try to get a working definition of capitalism. I looked it up on Wiki. I tried finding a definition of capitalism, and all of them seemed vague. So what is the working definition you use when you talk about capitalism?
Well, capitalism comes in different forms. Traditional capitalism was small business, entrepreneurial, competitive capitalism, the kind of free market theory that used to be dominant in textbooks. We live in a very different world. We live in a corporate-dominated capitalism with very large corporations able to dominate key sectors, and moreover, obviously, critically able to dominate good parts of the political realm as well. I live in Washington and this place, and I used to work on both houses of Congress when I was younger and decided that was not the most interesting place to be. But you find swarming kind of consultants and lobbyists and any little wrinkle, tiny wrinkle in the law, they can find a way to use it. The bankers are up there right now trying to rewrite the regulations that come with the new banking laws. So this is a different animal, and to say nothing of the way in which corporations are funding political campaigns. and attack ads. This is a very different form of capitalism than the vision that was once put forward as the free market capitalism. We live in a corporate-dominated system.
So what would a healthy capitalist society look like?
Well, in theory, and as you know, my book is An America Beyond Both Kinds of Capitalism, and
right.
Talk about that. In theory, that's small and medium-sized businessmen competing openly in the market, keeping each other efficient by challenging each other's production, by coming up with better inventions, and efficiency as a result of that, and new ideas coming out of that. That's the theory of efficient capitalism. It has obviously been challenged on many fronts. For one thing, tends to overshoot. We've had, even with that kind of capitalism, there's no guarantee you'll have full production or full employment. We have big cycles in the 19th century when we had more of that kind of capitalism, busts and booms. There's no regulator that works that way. And old Adam Smith, who is theoretically the godfather of that kind of capitalism, famously argued, well, you know, when you actually look at it, very often put two or three capitalists together, this is Adam Smith talking, not me, they will find a way to get cahoots with the kind of language and organize the market so that it isn't so competitive. They'd rather cut a deal, and both of them benefit more, but the consumer and the worker might not benefit. But anyway, that's the way it's supposed to work. It didn't work quite the way people thought it should.
Well, the reason I ask that is because we're talking about going beyond capitalism, and it's in the title of your book. So I wanted to get a working definition of it,
sure.
And I think that that's good to know that we are living in a kind of a corporate-dominated system of capitalism that has concentrated the wealth in this country to a pretty startling level. So, Gar Alperovitz, give us a snapshot of where America stands right now as a capitalist society in terms of wealth concentration.
Well, it's very hard to grasp these numbers because they are so off the charts, really. The top 1%, and I think the Occupy people were really right to pick on 1% versus the 99%,
mm-hmm.
but the top 1% own just about a little bit under half of the investment capital. Now, think about that. That's 1% of the society owning just about half of the factories, the farms, the product of the stores, the businesses of all kinds. That means an extreme concentration. That, you know, technically, and I'm not using rhetoric here, that's kind of the way medieval society was organized, with
right.
the lords owning, you know, so much of the land in that case. That was
a feudal system, so to speak.
Yeah, a feudal system. And we're just beginning to realize these concentrations. And that's investment capital. I mean, it's not counting your houses and your cars, which is sometimes part of the way you estimate net worth or wealth. Another figure that I saw recently and didn't believe until I checked it out, 400 individuals, you can find the four, you know, the richest people in Forbes magazine, 400 people in a society of 300 and just about 315 million have more wealth, net worth, that's including everything beyond the factories, that includes the houses and cars and other parts of the that aren't factories. They have more than the bottom 60%. So it's a very, very, 400 people having that much wealth is a very concentrated society, and hardly your picture of the competitive free enterprise capitalist with lots of individuals competing with each other in roughly the same playing field.
Right. This is not a healthy free market competitive system. This is a system that's rigged to favor the most powerful, and there is a direct relationship between the accumulation of wealth and the accumulation of power. We're going to take a break, Gar, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about something that Noam Chomsky said and talk about, you know, the dialectic that's been in play in the last century between, you know, private capitalist system on the one hand and then the state concentration of power on the other, and how both of those aren't working, and how your book is trying to point the way to a third way of doing things. You're listening to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, in for Norman Goldman. This is the place where justice is served. Our guest is Gar Alperovitz. He's going to be here the whole hour. If you have a question or you want to join the conversation, again, this is not a conversation we want to have at you, but rather with you. The number is 1-888-321-6001. Again, 1-888-321-6001. This is the Norman Goldman Show, the place where justice is served. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, sitting in for Norman Goldman this week. This is the place where justice is served. Our guest is a gentleman named Gar Alperovitz. GarAlperovitz.com is the website to learn more about him. He has written a book called America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Gar, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to bounce a Noam Chomsky quote off you in a moment, but we do have a caller on the line who wants some clarification on the 1%. Mark in Napa, you're on with Gar Alperovitz.
Good evening, gentlemen. Just two things. One, what does it take to be a one percenter? I mean, how much do they make a year? I'm just curious what the wealth of a one percenter is on average.
I don't have the figure on wealth on average. And last I looked at it, you get to the top 1%, I think, at just about $350,000 to $375,000 per year in income.
Just an income.
Wealth, it's much higher.
Okay. And the other thing I just thought of is, you know, I think the Democrats are just as guilty as the Republicans. I mean, did I just read that Nancy Pelosi is going to a $10,000 a night resort in Hawaii?
I didn't see that, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Nor would I. Thanks for the call, Mark. I do appreciate it. So I want to lay this idea on you for a response. Noam Chomsky, I remember reading this, that he said it didn't matter. We were talking about feudalism. It doesn't matter what system of government is in place, whether it's feudalism, socialism, capitalism. Wealth and power have a tendency to concentrate. And we've seen this in this last century, certainly between capitalism and socialism, where on the one hand you have capitalism, where we've seen this extraordinary concentration of private wealth and power. And then socialism, on the other hand, would strive to be the cure for capitalism, only to end up with large concentrations of state wealth and power. In your book, you talk about constructing a third way. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's not a hybrid vision. It's really the way to think about it. At least I've tried to put it out there. And the purpose of the book, America Beyond Capitalism, hopefully is to open a discussion of something other than the two alternatives you just outlined. I don't think we're stuck with those. I think we can escape that kind of either-or logic. And my way of thinking about it and is to start in any one community and ask yourself, how would we democratize to the furthest extent possible right here in this town? That's ground zero. I'm from a fading industrial town in Wisconsin, Racine, Wisconsin. It's about 100,000. So I always start thinking that way. And when you do it that way, you can begin to think and look around the country at what's already developing. And what you find just beneath the surface of, you know, what you see in the press doesn't cover, there are something like 140 million Americans today who are members of a different kind of economic alternative that is democratic or can be democratic. It's one person, one vote. I'm talking about co-ops and credit union co-ops.
Right.
So 140 million people are that. What does that look like? That's not corporate capitalism, and that's certainly not state socialism. That starts at the bottom and gives you a kind of image of a decentralized vision. Now, obviously, you have to go beyond that, but starting there is not a bad place. And if you look around the country, there are about 13,000 companies that are owned by workers directly. And that's really something 5 or 6 million more than people are involved and are involved in labor unions, about 13 million people. And again, right on the ground level in American communities, they don't get much publicity, but there they are. And it gives you another kind of image starting in a local community. Or if you look around, another very simple thing is publicly owned utilities. And publicly owned utilities, just a municipal utility, and co-ops provide something like 25% of the electricity in the United States today. And I could go on, but the press doesn't cover this. And the idea of America Beyond Capitalism is to decentralize and democratize the ownership of wealth as much as is technically feasible, starting there. And building, secondly, and building from the community up. And third, starting with practical things that we know something about rather than abstractions. So that's the kind of way in which I begin to, in the book, lay out and try to research. America Beyond Capitalism really starts by researching things on the ground that are available, and you can find it now on the Internet. And I can mention a couple sites, community-wealth surveys this kind of material, put the dash in, because there's another one without the dash. And what you find is that there's literally thousands of developments in cities across the country that are really quite exciting. We can talk about some in cities like, there's one really interesting one in Cleveland we can come back to. But they start moving up in scale. And then you begin to ask what larger kinds of things might be possible. And what you find, for instance, is in the state of North Dakota, there's a public bank that's been there for 90 years, and it, instead of speculating on the international market and buying derivatives and taking very big risks, it in fact helps rebuild the state, the economy of the state. So you can find that kind of thing. And in other states, for even in Alaska, again, working from the bottom and then working up to higher scale, many people know about the Alaska Permanent Fund, where they take, this is a conservative state, but they take oil revenues and democratize them. They go out as a matter of legal right. The dividends go out to everybody in the state. And the last time I looked, it was close to $10,000 for a husband, wife, and a couple, and three kids. So that's another example in very American, but a slightly larger scale. And the book really attempts to do this and moves up the scale. Obviously, you've got to come to larger institutions at some point and begin to think about how do we apply these principles at higher levels. But if you look at the New Deal, the way the New Deal was constructed was starting at the state level, learning really different principles, in that case, labor law and health and safety of workers and many other pension funds and public social security, starting in state ideas. But taking those kind of principles, in the case we're talking about democratizing ownership, and then just advancing those to higher levels as necessary, when the New Deal came, they became national levels. So the vision put forward in this book begins at that kind of community-sustaining picture and tries to work its way up to democratizing the ownership of wealth rather than putting it in the hands of the 1% and the giant corporations, or, on the other hand, putting it all in the state. That's the vision.
That's our sound for the break. Gar Alpovitz is our guest. This is the Norman Goldman Show. Your calls are next. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, sitting in for Norm this week. It has been my pleasure to be at the place where justice is served and where fierce independence is the norm. Our guest is Gar Alpovitz. GarAlpovitz.com is the website, GarAlpovitz.com. His book, America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. I just love saying the title. It is so reassuring because, you know what, folks? It is possible. And these past 2 weeks, I've tried to bring people to the show who can show us the way to reclaiming our democracy, our liberty, and our wealth. Gar Alpovitz, welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show.
Terrific to be here with you.
I'm going to go to some callers because I often say this is not a conversation that we want to have at them, but rather with them. So, Patrick, in Chicago, you're on with Gar Alpovitz.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a couple things I wanted to comment on. I agree with what your guest said about the public bank and that we shouldn't be signed on to derivatives. I think that's great. But I disagree with this whole notion of the 1%. People in that margin are making anywhere above $300,000 a year. I think that's pretty much incorrect.
Then what do you think it is? Do you think it's higher or lower than that?
Oh, I think it's much higher. I think it's the Warren Buffett. I think it's the British royalty, the people who own all the oil companies who basically are totally exempt, while people who are making over $300,000 anywhere from that bracket up to about $10 million are not in that bracket whatsoever. They're taxed probably 30-40%, just like most Americans.
Well, it may be true. Gard, you want to take a crack at that? I know you said that you didn't have the exact statistic, but yeah. I think you did make a distinction between income and wealth.
Yeah, I think what he's pointing to and what the caller is pointing to, but people are surprised that point you get up to the 1% level at the top. Now, within the 1%, the people you're talking about at the top 0.1% have huge concentrations of income and wealth. But in fact, you know, the median income in the United States, median family income, is about $50,000. So when you get up to close to $400,000 and are at the 1% level, that's very high up for most people. But the concentrations of real ownership, and here I agree with him, are even above that level, so that the occupation might well have talked about the 99.9% versus the time 0.1% and made it sharper in terms of ownership of the big dollars.
Patrick, thanks for the call. I do appreciate it. Chris Rock made a great distinction once. He said, Shaq is rich. The guy who writes his check is wealthy. And I think that wealth is about being able to buy things like basketball teams, people that have high, high concentrations of wealth. I found out that Daryl Issa actually has somewhere between a net worth of somewhere between $190 and $700 million. That's the kind of wealth that we're talking about. And certainly you're going to generate a lot more than $300,000 or $400,000. I think that's the starting point. Numbers here, if you want to join the conversation with Gar Alpovitz, author of America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy, call in at 1-888-321-6001. That's 1-888-321-6001. Let's go to Brian in Chicago. You're on with Gar Alpovitz.
Hey, thanks, Adam. Great show. Great guest. I wanted to make a quick comment to what I think is probably the biggest assault on free market capitalism, and that is what your last guest was talking about, the Citizens United case. He had mentioned that 2 million people had signed on, and I think that's great, and I personally signed on. There's over 50 or 60 million people that voted for Barack Obama, and a lot of those people are progressives that are complaining that he didn't go far enough. And I think one of the big reasons that he wasn't able to, and he was prevented from going further in some of his campaign promises, is the election in 2010, which wasn't funded by the people of the United States. It was funded by the corporation. And until we overturn that, I don't think we're going to get the White House or the Congress or the Senate back to be able to make the decisions that progressives want to move forward.
Thanks for the call, Brian. I think that, Gar, why don't you take it? But I think that we're talking about you're talking about democratization of our whole processes, which means bringing it down to a very local level, right? Is that a fair response to what the caller's challenge?
He's absolutely right that the political process has been, you know, totally perverted by money and subverted. That said, it's going to be a long, hard fight to turn around the political process and to turn around the not only the laws, but the way in which this really conservative court has interpreted the Constitution. So I think there's a fight on many different levels, but I would not wait until we turn that around to begin starting at the bottom and working our way up, both in politics, but also in changing these institutions, building a base that can begin to give some power to a different vision and to some muscle to the a different movement. So, again, I would go back, and the way to think about it, think about the women's movement and how it took many decades, several decades, building from the bottom, decade by decade, and state by state, finding ways to make inroads and laying the groundwork until you finally got the vote nationally. And the same, as I said, in the New Deal. So working hard at the bottom. Or take another example. If you had looked at the civil rights movement, my heroes in the civil rights movement are the people who began fighting for civil rights in states like Mississippi, where they would hang you if you moved in the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. People in the 1930s and 40s, when it looked impossible, they began laying the groundwork. Those are the real heroes for something that exploded in the 1960s. And I think we're in similar straits right now, that we're going to have to work hard to take piece by piece, city by city, state by state, building up over time and building a different practice, building different institutions like these worker-owned co-ops and city municipalities, municipal ownership, and state banks, and single payer state by state. There are 14 states considering state banks, and about 15 or 16 considering single payer. Building up the networks from the bottom up to change the undergirding of our society. And we may have some national crises. And I think when the next fiscal next financial crisis comes, and I think virtually all experts think there's going to be another banking crisis,
right,
we may see some of those taken over nationally at the national level. We pretty much bailed them out with taxpayer money that pretty much equaled buying them out and could have been a buyout. We nationalized Chrysler, and GM. Things like that, I think, are going to be happening in the future as well because of the crisis. But slowly, I think the most important thing is working from the bottom up and beginning to change things.
Yes, I talk a lot about this idea of relocating the center of power from somewhere out there or somewhere in Washington or somewhere on Capitol Hill to right where we live, right where we are, and beginning to take action in these kind of small ideas. If there's time, I want to talk about Cleveland because there's really something remarkable going on there in terms of cooperatives, something quite large, but I want to take another call. We have Sean in Washington. You're on with Gar Alpovitz on the Norman Goldman Show.
Mr. Alpovitz, so long as we still have the demands of the free market, of the capitalist system, which are to maximize profit and market share, I don't really understand what difference it'll make if we have worker-owned cooperatives or state banks. Those iron laws will still be in place. I guess you're kind of outlining a kind of market socialism, but I would be much more in favor of some sort of economic central planning. I'm a communist. I'm a Marxist, and I think we need to be open and use that kind of language. It's, you know, one thing about the 1930s, you know, what pressured the Democratic Party? Was it people talking about, you know, amendments to the Constitution or legislative or judicial actions? No, it was the Communist Party overtly challenging people like Paul Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, people who said, we have an alternative system to your system, and we're not going to participate in your sham bourgeois capitalist system. We have and it seems like we need to be upfront. Why aren't people using this language? This is what worked back in the 30s. Why aren't we using this language now? Thank you.
Great question. Great call, Sean. Gar?
Well, there are two or three different levels of, and it's, I'm glad those are good questions. And,
yeah,
and they're the kind of questions that have to be discussed and debated.
Yes.
So I appreciate it. The first level of it is, look, the design of the Soviet Union and most Eastern European countries, there are a lot of different questions involved, the war, the feudal background, those countries were backward, et cetera, but the design of that particular kind of socialism or communism was a state-dominated system. And I agree with Chomsky and I agree with the conservatives who were right about the fact that if you put all of the capital ownership in the hands of the state, what you end up with is a concentration of power that can undermine democracy.
Right.
So I don't accept that model, and I disagree with the caller on that.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think he's that if you look at small and medium-sized business, there is the potential and indeed existing a competitive market, and there's nothing wrong with using that when it works, and indeed it sometimes keeps the bureaucrats honest. But that's kind of a way of checking the balance of what's going on. If we get to the Cleveland model, there's some interesting mixes of planning is needed, in my opinion. We're going to need planning, and I can give you some examples of that. But you can start and ask the question, when is it needed and when is it not, rather than either or. And I think when you start that way, you come up with a whole series of things that obviously need planning. Let's take the most obvious. The national health care system needs planning, and you're talking about 20% of the U.S. economy very shortly. So that whole system is now being rigged by the corporations and the hospitals and the insurance companies, but it could very well become a planned quadrant or 20% of the society in a way that is efficient and effective. But again, starting with the community level where the best experiments show you the direction that we ought to be designing planning for. I'll give you another example. If we, and I've written about this elsewhere, and America Beyond Capitalism refers to these kinds of ideas. At some point, we're going to need a whole new rail system. We already need it.
Yes.
And we need mass transit and high-speed rail. The fact is the United States doesn't have anybody that produces high-speed rail, and we only assemble some mass transit vehicles that are built elsewhere in other countries. Well, that's a whole new industry. It's going to be all paid for by the taxpayer and by commuters why in the world should we give that over to some build up some new company? Why couldn't that be a company owned nationally and by the workers in particular communities jointly and build that whole system? Now, that's going to require planning of the transport system. Now, we do plan the transport system every day when the U.S. government pays for huge highway construction. That's one plan, and they tax the payer, they tax people through the gas taxes to pay for that, but it is a plan.
Right.
It's a plan that redesigned our suburbs and our cities. So planning goes on, but a planning for mass transit, high-speed rail, would also create a new industry, and there you have another segment of the society that does need planning, but that doesn't mean everything needs planning.
That's
so
right.
Piece by piece, rather than these broad strokes or rhetoric about it, I think, and I wrote America Beyond Capitalism precisely for that reason. It's time for us to sit down and begin to chew on this problem and get away from the rhetoric and say, what actually makes sense? Where do we want competition? Where do we want planning? I think another piece of this puzzle in a system that is so large, I mean, our country, we don't realize how big it is. It's continental. You can drop Germany into Montana.
I know.
Those are tiny little countries.
Right.
And ours is a continent. So we're going to need, obviously, some kind of break or some sort of regional development strategies because the continent's too big for real democracy. How do you have participatory democracy in a continent with now 300 million moving to 500 million people? Obviously, and many states are too small, so obviously at some point the intermediate unit of a region is going to be important in all of this, including planning.
Right.
But I wrote this book, and you know, America Beyond Capitalism, to say, let's get beyond the rhetoric. Let's start talking about what would be a way to democratize ownership, democratize, reclaim our wealth and our democracy and our liberty. And I might have added, and I do add in the book, our ecological sustainability.
Absolutely.
And get concrete about it rather than rhetorical and look at things on the ground we can build on. That's the whole point of the book.
Our guest has been Gar Alpovitz, GarAlpovitz. The book is America Beyond Capitalism, Reclaiming Our Wealth, Our Liberty, and Our Democracy. Gar Alpovitz, thank you so much for coming on. An absolute pleasure. I hope we can have you on again sometime.
Appreciate it very much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You're listening to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, in for Norman Goldman. This has been an incredible 2 weeks. I've really, really enjoyed myself. When we come back, it's going to be my parting shot and well wishes to you in the new year. This is the Norman Goldman Show, the place where justice is served. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Norman Goldman Show. I'm Adam Klugman, who has been sitting in for Norman Goldman for, about 2 weeks now, having a great time because I like sitting in a place where justice is served and where fierce independence is the norm. I had a conversation with Norm just before I went on the air, and I was talking to him a little bit about it and saying I was beating up on Obama a little bit, and people came in, and Norm said, Adam, you can say whatever you want to say on the show, because he's somebody who's committed to the idea of fierce independence. And before I wrap up, I also want to put a huge shout out to all of the listeners, all of the callers, all of the emailers who've offered their incredible words of support. It has been a really great experience for me. I've tried to bring together the people in these 2 weeks that I think can help us craft a vision of how we go forward from here. There is so much negativity for a lot of really good reasons. I don't like that word negativity. What I mean to say is there's so much good reason for discouragement in this world. All you have to do is wake up and go to the internet or turn on your TV or listen to your radio, and what you will see is a lot of reasons to get down. But the truth is, we are more ingenious than our own worst tendencies. We've got to believe that. And as we move into this new year, I put forth the idea that what we really need to be doing and what we really need to be working on is changing our thoughts about the world. That's why I've tried to bring together people that can guide us through this. There are good ideas out there. That is really the point. There is no shortage of good ideas, of ingenuity, of inspiration, of commitment. My God, this is the United States of America. This is what we are known for. We are known for courage. We are known for ingenuity, for imagination, for creativity, persistence. This is our national character. We must not abandon that in favor of the hypnotism that comes to us through all of the screens that we see in our world. We must refuse that. And in this new year, I encourage you and I demand of myself a new way of thinking and a new way of being in the world. That what we have to do, as our last guest, Gar Alpervitz, was talking about, was get involved right where we are. Stop locating the power outside of ourselves. Because when we do that, we defer our own personal power. And what do we get? We get Newt Gingrich can control my life, or President Obama, or the Democratic Party. Yes, all of these things have an impact, but they are not where the power ultimately lies. And I think this is what the Occupy movement is teaching us. I think, as our last guest was saying, we are coalescing a movement. It's a little bit disparate right now, scattered around in different places, but there are huge energies in place. Huge powers decentralized in the people. That's you and me. Don't sell yourself short. Don't sell your neighbor short. Don't sell your friend short by thinking that they don't have the capacity or that you don't have the capacity to change the world. In fact, you are the only person who can. And the only way to do that is to relocate the center of power from Washington to right here, to right there, to right where you are, to right where I am. So I want you to have an incredibly happy, healthy, prosperous new year. I wish that for you. For your family, for your friends, I wish it for myself and my family and my friends. It has been a pleasure. I'm Adam Klugman signing out for 2011. This is the Norman Goldman Show. I'll talk to you soon.